Some of you in this congregation have memories of fleeing World War II or being in America to learn of the atrocities of World War II and to see the redemptive capacity of the land of Israel. More of you in this room can probably recall a time where Jews were not admitted to significant universities or know of neighborhoods where Jews were under restrictive covenant not to be admitted. Most of us in the room know that Cherokee Country Club did not admit Jews until about three decades ago. I never lived through a period where I felt insecure as a Jew. And I can't speak for all of us. In fact, I know there are people who have strongly disagreed with me about what I'm about to say. This recent time, 12, 18 months, is the first time in my life as a minority, ethnic, religious, that I feel insecure. And I think some of you share that feeling. I know of people who are Latino who feel that, of women. If you talk to African Americans, they'll tell you what else is new. But we live, to my way of thinking, and I hope that this sentiment is understood, if not shared, before I go on, in a time of creeping insecurity, which I hope won't endure, but I do want to address it together. There are a few people whom I will owe thanks for this talk, two people who have provided me with a thought point. The first is Arnold Cohen, who taught me this from William O. Douglas, who was a Supreme Court justice appointed by Roosevelt some many years ago. As nightfall does not come all at once, neither does oppression. In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged. We live in a dim period where truly the future is uncertain. And God forbid it may be a twilight before a darker period. It could also, God willing, be dusk before the dawn, and things can seem dark. And some of you have said to me, I don't feel uncomfortable. This is no greater threat than I knew in my home country or when I was young or at other periods in my life. That may be true. We know of our Muslim neighbors, our Guatemalan neighbors, our Black neighbors who experience minority insecurity to a greater degree, I think, now than in much of the recent past, in my lifetime for sure. And when there is threat to one group, when the majority would exercise its populist will against one minority, we are all at risk. We know at some kernel in our hearts that to be true. The 20th century author James Baldwin said, "If they come for you in the morning, they'll be coming for us at night." I don't want to catastrophize. I hope we are living at dusk and not twilight, that the weather will clear, that the storm of intolerance, which seems to be growing, to my vantage point, I don't want to speak for everyone. I am no expert on politics. I am barely an expert on our religious faith and tradition, and that's the angle I approach from. I think of America as among the greatest projects the human race has ever begun. The idea of a nation, at least in its fruition, certainly in its earliest iterations, whole groups of people were excluded from participation. But in its mission, the idea of a nation where all are beholden to the law, where individuals are protected by separation of powers and a Bill of Rights, and the idea of a nation that is not French for French people, although I know I've had conversations with French people that to misstate that, that is not beholden to one tribe or ethnicity for its identity. We are a panoply of people, a wonderful and diverse spectrum, and that's what makes us great. As I guess all Jewish people understand, the process of migration, emigration, and immigration is a piece of what makes us rich and successful. This is not the primary topic of my talk, but in the summer, by the beach, there are ice cream trucks, the bane of every parent's existence, because your children will just hear the sound and start to salivate and demand your money. There's a fellow, Khaled, who has a light blue truck. The other trucks are white, and somehow we've only give our patronage to his truck. It's been a tradition for years, and he'll give our kids free ice cream and free gifts and candies, and he checks. This is halal. It will be kosher. There's no gelatin in this. He's a Jordanian immigrant who has not only has this business, I think, but also some other businesses with his brothers and son. His son, I think, is an executive, not at Comcast, but a significant multinational. And I was talking to him and wondered what a world would be like without people like Khaled, if America had no immigration. And I don't know if he feels discomfort as an Arab and Muslim immigrant, but I can imagine at times he does. He leaves a backpack unattended for more than a few minutes. But I do believe that this nation, us among it, we among it, have the chance to be great, have the chance to be better, have the chance to stride through this difficult patch, these interesting times in which we live. Ronald Reagan, in 87, at the Constitution's bicentennial, described the Constitution as a covenant, a brit, or as the translation was in this morning's Torah reading in our Machzor, a pact. He says, "It's a pact not only with ourselves, but with all of mankind. Our duty is to constantly renew the covenant with humanity and complete the work begun more than 200 years ago, the grand noble work that is America's particular calling, the triumph of human freedom under God." Is there anything we could desire more as Jews and Americans but to be free under God, to be a liberated ethnic minority, to have the same level of success as the Jews of 13th century Spain or the Jews of 18th century Poland, but to have that continue and endure? We live not in paralyzing times, but in fear-making times. I can tell by your silence, and you are acknowledging that you experience some of the things I experience. We also live in a time that I despise, when the ends are stretched and stretched, and the middle is thinner and thinner. And there is a sociological and sociopolitical concept called the Overton window of what is acceptable public discourse, and now good taste is being taken and thrown out the Overton window, that span of appropriate discourse seems to be stretched close to its breaking point, and people find themselves so polarized, so much at one end or another. I think there's got to be a different way, and there is a way from our tradition I want to talk to you about. It uses the word resistance, but I'm not speaking of the resistance that used colloquially today in newspapers. I'm going to share with you a term mostly from World War II, but some of the ideas precede it. It's called spiritual resistance. It is, to quote Deborah Olashansky, I think the concept of holding center, that in mad times we strive to remain sane. As Pirkei Avot would say, in a place where there is no human being, strive to be a mensch, strive to be a human. We do not live in those chaotic, cataclysmic times yet. And all the more important that we hold the center so that this nation and this world never even get close again. So here's some insight from our tradition. There is a Rebbe in the Hasidic tradition named Mordechai Menachem Mendel of Vorka, which I think is in eastern Poland. He lived in the 19th century, and he said this enigmatic thing. There are three indications of the salt of the earth. They know how to surrender while standing erect, shout by being silent, and dance with no movement whatsoever. Surrender while standing erect, shout by being silent, and dance with no movement whatsoever. What a crippling paradox that presents. We know a lot of people who shout, but very people who do it with silence. We know a lot of people who surrender but don't remain unbent. But I want to remind you of a couple who were able to do it. The first one many of you knew personally, and I spoke of her last year, Mindy. Aleha HaShalom, may her spirit be blessed with peace. Mindy Goldberg. When I asked her the reality of her illness, that pancreatic cancer isn't something one survives, certainly not as long as she did. And as I said last year, I thought maybe she was being a touch naive. Nope. She said, each day I wake up with a choice. I can die or I can walk through fire. So I walk through fire. This is the year we all have to be walking through fire. And not in an incendiary way, not in a provocative way, but in a way that surrenders by standing erect and shouts by being silent. In a way that dances without movement. In a way that holds the vital center of the Jewish people, of East Tennessee, of Tennessee, and of our great nation, and by doing so, keeps the world intact, at least in our own small way. We all are blessed, I hope, with heroes. Mindy became one of mine. There are two others I want to talk to you about. The first is someone I never knew, and the second is someone I met briefly. The first is one who did not live in my generation, and the second is one who somewhat did. There was a fellow, Kalonymous Kalman Shapiro, one of the latter generations of Elimelech of Lizhensk. He lived in Poland. He was born in 1889. He wrote several works, including a spiritual journal, educational tracts of pedagogy for children, all of which merit reading. And he became the Rebbe of the Warsaw Ghetto, which was bombed and progressively annihilated by typhus and deportations to camps and starvation. During the bombings, he saw a child and an in-law son die. He was never naive or willfully Pollyanna about what was going on. And yet he remained. There is, I've been alerted to, a tradition, as I said, called spiritual resistance, which is most exemplified in those ghettos. The challenge to remain human even under inhumane conditions. Our people, whom we foolishly have sometimes thought of as sheep, we were so wrong. They maintained archives, libraries, schools, healthcare institutions, educational institutions for children in the worst of the worst times. We stood up to remain human even when we were degraded. They believed us to be horrible, but that didn't make us terrible. We did not become our enemies. We did not become the very thing that they hated. We rose above. And Kalonymus Kalman Shapira is often called the Esh Kodesh, the holy fire, just like Mindy. Not because he walked through fire, but because a collection of his sermons, as recorded by his Hasidim, as recorded by his disciples and students, things he would say over the Shabbat table that they later wrote after the Shabbat, after the Sabbath, were recorded, written, and stored in a strong milk jug, the kind Tevye would have used. You can see a picture of it. And it was unearthed after the war, and we have the records of the sermons from the years of fury. I have not read all of them. I've read a plurality of them. Some of you have read them with me. Each page is a lesson for me. Decades after his death, of course, he was murdered by the Nazis in 43, though he had at various times the chance to leave. They gave him opportunities, and he would not leave his community. But those sermons, first and foremost, they challenge God. Because in the most polite way possible, they say, God, have you seen what's happening here? Do you know how bad it is? We're waiting. And on the other end, as I pointed, they're not Pollyanna. They do not imagine that the world is simple or naturally good. He never offers his students, his disciples, his congregants, his loved ones simple answers. But he tries to hold a candle of hope that at some point the Jewish people, that some of these spirits, that some of these, even some of these bodies will survive, and that God's justice will be meted out or at least observed at some point in the future, even if, especially if and when you can't see it right now. He did not let them despair, and he did not pretend that things would all be okay. So what do we do in this era, which, for the record, I don't think is a preamble to destruction or cataclysm? It could be, but every day can be a preamble to cataclysm if you're going to think about it that way. But I do see incredible strain and stress on our body politic, on the Jewish people, and thereby reverberating through the world. If we're understood to be Or LaGoyim, a light to the nations, it has to start here. And frankly, I'm not addressing or don't have the voice to address others, so I am addressing you that you may reverberate with our wisdom and carry it forward in a way that heals the world. But first, my other hero was visiting a congregant at a rehab two Fridays ago and watched the state funeral for John McCain. I didn't let anyone know this until maybe the past 2 years. I vaguely and obliquely mentioned that I've worked on a presidential campaign before. But for lack of a desire to alienate anyone, I would never say who it was. I'd let you think. Could have been Nixon. But it was the year 2000. I had just gotten back from the Peace Corps, and John McCain was speaking the rhetoric of courage and decency, as he really did his whole life with a few exceptions. And I probably wouldn't vote for some of the same things that he would vote for, but I understood him to be a person whom I could respect and trust. And nowhere has that been more clear to me than in his extended funeral. And I was really surprised how sad it made me, this fear that it was an elegy for an America that may no longer be. An America of civility and argument for the sake of joyful argument and seeking the truth, not argument for the sake of vilifying your opponent. In various interviews, he talks about the importance of listening over vitriol. something, as Jews we should know well. We are a community of grapplers, Yisrael, the God fighter. We are a community of arguers. Our Talmud is full of debate. But I want to point out another piece. We do not just argue for argument's sake. We do not argue for vitriol or to demean or create ad hominem attacks against our opponents. We argue to strive for truth, and we argue with listening as our highest principle. David Cohen, the writer of the Kol Nevuah, which was written about in the mid-20th century, points out that the Babylonian Talmud, one of our most sacred corpuses after the Torah, the Pentateuch, uses metaphors of understanding not related to the eyes, but almost exclusively to the ears. The ancient people often talked about come and see, you will observe. Judaism, in the Aramaic of the Talmud, almost always uses the same root as Shema, Shin Mem Ayin, listen, hear, understand, internalize. The phrase Tashma introduces an argument, come and hear. Kamashmalan, this teaches us, we learn from this, we hear through this. Shmamina, hear of this, infer from this. Lo Shemayale, he had not heard this, he did not agree. Most importantly, a traditional teaching is not referred to as something written or seen, it is referred to as a hearing, a shemaita. As Jonathan Sacks, the great rabbi of Britain, says in analyzing the Kol Nevuah, crowds are moved by great speakers, but lives are changed by great listeners. If we strive to, and I hope you will strive with me, to hold the vital center of our community, of our nation, as Deborah Olashansky phrased it, to hold the center, listening is the first piece. So many people just shout and speak louder and louder as a way to win an argument. But if you're not listening to the other side, again, perhaps just the things that belong in the Overton window, but if you're not listening to people who disagree with you, who, as our mayors have said, good people can disagree, what are you doing with your ears? How will you ever learn? How will you ever grow as a person? How will you ever participate in the healing of this nation? Madeline Rahero, lovely, authentic, decent person that she is, spoke to us about her time in Israel about a year ago, a little less than a year ago. And she quoted Tal Becker, who is at the Israeli Foreign Ministry, who is also a fellow at the Hartman Institute, saying that one should, quote, spend time on the other side's victory speech. That's how you build peace. That's how, as Aaron, Moses' brother, is known, Ohev Shalom v'Rodef Shalom, to love peace and wholeness and to seek after it. Learn about the other culture. Learn what the other side needs. Listen, understand, strive. Tearing each other down does no good and just contributes to the cycle of hatred and polarization and division and cold civil war that this nation is experiencing in my lifetime. And the degradation of minorities, and in cases women, African Americans, Latinos, now Jews, if they come for one, they'll be coming for us soon. And we have to do this. We have to engage in the process of healing with our ears, but also with our hands. Engaging each other in brotherhood and fellowship. Recognizing that you are not my enemy. You are not my enemy. I do not detract from or insult or impugn your motives. We are all striving to understand God, striving to, as Reagan noted, be part of the project of human freedom under God, that we are trying to understand our Jewish tradition, and we do it with good faith, that we are trying to live the American dream, and we do that with good faith. Israel Salanter, the forerunner of the Musar movement, the ethical revival movement in Lithuania in the 19th century, says, Someone who wants to be greater than others should not dig a pit for a friend. He should build a hill for himself. When you're in the batter's box, it's not in a pit. The pitcher has the advantage because he's on a mound. You don't do any good by hammering other people down and impugning their motives. You don't do any good by diminishing the other side's godliness. You have to be better. That's the message, whether you care for this message or not, of covenant and chosenness. That God calls us, I don't believe in exceptionalism, but as a metaphor, we in this room must be better. It's not easy. And we must join hands together with those with whom we disagree. We must listen to the other side. We must look out for people who are different than us in physicality, in orientation, in belief. We must understand America not as a majoritarian country, but as a country that protects each individual and each group and assuages their fears and ensures their safety. Do not put others in a hole. Build a mound for yourself. Listen. Walk through fire and engage in the spiritual resistance of not being as bad as anyone else. Be better. Remain human even in difficult times. My message may change in a year or two if, God forbid, things get worse, but for now, what we can do this year is model citizenship, is model good Jewishness, whether you are Jewish at birth or by choice or not yet Jewish, or just someone who is part of our community by affiliation. This tradition, our Mesorah, our Torah and Talmud, and the American Constitution are there to guide us to be our best selves and to share together in the enterprise of spiritual resistance. I want to leave you with something that's becoming one of my favorite poems by the Jewish poet, Marge Piercy. She writes from Massachusetts. I don't recall the exact year of this poem. But this poem is called The Low Road. And it's about the importance of joining together. The low road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up. They can bust you. They can break your fingers. They can burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take your child, wall up your lover. They can do anything. You can't blame them from doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take what revenge you can, but they roll over you. But two people, fighting back to back, can cut through a mob. A snake dancing file can break a cordon. An army can meet an army. Two people can keep each other sane, can give support, conviction, love, massage, hope. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge and start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen make a demonstration, 100 fill a hall, 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000, power and your own paper, 100,000, your own media, 10 million, your own country. It starts one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day, you mean one more.